He returned to New York to work in state government, then headed back to warmer climates and took a job at Harper's Ferry as an exhibit planner. Perhaps because he was seeking an even warmer climate than Harper's Ferry, in 1995 he agreed to be the assistant superintendent of Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. And in 2002, he said yes to being their chief historian. Along the way, he's written more books and contributed articles to periodicals and has helped Gary Gallagher complete two of his books. When I asked John Hennessy if he would speak to our round table, he replied that he would be happy to come. The Bull Run Civil War round table is one of his favorite groups on earth and one of the few that automatically get a yes when he's asked. I think the feeling is mutual. Please help me to welcome John Hennessy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was a business section of the meeting that was way more interesting than anything I could do. So it's all downhill from here, but it's nice to be here. It's a little daunting to be in front of this round table for a lot of reasons. John McEnaw, after all these years, knows my book better than I do, I'm sure. And some of you I've known since I was a child, virtually, at Manassas. And because I only come here every few years, you're probably astonished at how old I look than every time I appear. So it's a little bit daunting on that account. When we talked about what to talk about tonight, we just got as far as Second Manassas, and we never defined it any more than that. And I still haven't, as a matter of fact. That is not a sign of disorganization, necessarily, but a sign that what I'd like to do tonight is kind of freeform this thing and to give you all a chance to, you know, ask questions, argue points, you know, just kind of have a free-form discussion about Second Manassas. We can talk about anything you want. We can talk about the process of writing the book. I'm always curious how other people write books, and if you're interested in that, I'll be glad to talk about that. We can talk about the evolution of the battlefield. We can talk about the battle itself. So it's really up to you. Now, what I did today in anticipation of this was wrote down 10 questions that, if I were you, I'd ask about Second Manassas. So we can start with that. But I understand you're giving a tour, you're having a tour. In fact, I've never done the walk that you're going to do this week, so that sounds interesting, except for the ticks part of it.
It's Virginia.
No, it's a great idea. It's something I never even attempted to do, as a matter of fact. So what I'll do is maybe take 10 minutes and just kind of give some broad context and overview of what this battle, what this campaign is all about, and leave you with 5 or 6 big points I hope you remember. You know, when we talk about battles, it's very easy to get immersed in the details. Americans know far more about the details of these battles than they knew about why they mattered in the first place, or often why they were fought in the first place. Second Manassas, often overlooked, because it's not the beginning, nor is it the end of anything. It's a bloody wayside along the way from the 7 days to Antietam. So we like our stuff to be conclusive, or at least the beginning of something, and Second Manassas is not that. Second Manassas is viewed to be a mismatch, a very simple clash of personalities that are at the opposite end of the American heroic spectrum. John Pope versus Robert E. Lee. Now, how interesting is that? But I would suggest to you that Second Manassas has much to tell us that's very important about the war. There are very few battles and campaigns that have as many political and policy implications for the nation as does Second Manassas. And let me just take a minute to explain that. why it matters. Now, it matters less, frankly, to the Confederates than it does to the Union war effort. The Union war effort in the summer of 1862 was, as you all know, staggering along. America was coming to the realization that this war would not, could not be resolved simply on the basis or by virtue of the clash of armies on the battlefield. This was a realization especially that was pertinent in Washington. Because, of course, out west, the Union had won battles, unlike in the Eastern Theater. In the Eastern Theater, they had struggled. The war effort had struggled. And as the war effort struggled, and many of you have probably heard me use this metaphor before, you know, the war started as a pretty surgical, confined event with a very specific purpose. It was a military endeavor, effort, to restore the South to the Union, from the northern perspective, of course, or from the southern perspective to, in most southerners' eyes, remove the South from the Union. But in any event, regardless of the goal, the event was envisioned in purely military terms. But it became pretty obvious, and this is one of the most important things you can understand about the Civil War, is that as the war went on, battles by themselves mattered less and less. Look, for example, at Chancellorsville. Lee's greatest victory, some would argue. I would argue Second Manassas is probably his greatest victory. But look at that. Lincoln's reaction. What will the country say? What will the country say? And what did the country say after Chancellorsville? Not much, did they? And the war ground along. Lee was frustrated by the fact that his victories did not produce the kind of dramatic outcomes that he and most Americans expected these battles would. I mean, look at First Manassas. The nation came out to watch because it was it. It was going to resolve 85 years of conflict at every level of American society, social, political, economic. All that was going to be resolved in 3 hours of conflict on Henry Hill on the afternoon of July 21st. I mean, it seems ridiculous now, but at the time, of course, it was not. But the most important thing about this war is that as it moved along, and as the nation grew to realize that the simple application of military force upon armies was not enough to resolve this conflict, the nature of the war grew. The war grew until eventually, in the end, it would ultimately address most, in some form at least, most if not all of the things that caused it in the first place. Now, as the war changed, how did it change? Summer of 1862, spring of 1862, the federal government emancipates slaves in Washington, D.C. Shortly thereafter, they passed the first of the Confiscation Acts, making Southern property fair game in the war. July of 1862, as John Pope is gearing up in Northern Virginia, Abraham Lincoln indicates his intent to issue a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. Which does what? For people who suggest that the Emancipation Proclamation was an empty document, it was clearly the most important single document ever issued by a United States president. It said that no longer is this war simply about restoring the Union. It's also about transforming the Union. And every soldier in the Union Army who marched under the American flag after January 1st, 1863, regardless of his motivations, and many of them, of course, were very upset about the addition of emancipation to the list of war aims. But you know what? After January 1st, 1863, every single one of them marched to liberate the slaves. As a matter of government policy, not as a matter of personal motivation, but of government policy. Now, I give you all that because the first manifestation in the field of this evolving and changing war was the arrival of John Pope in Virginia. His job was to come to Virginia, win battles, and change the nature of the war in Virginia. The first thing he did wasn't to lead his troops into battle, but to issue a series of general orders that permitted his troops to live off the land, that required men in southern communities to take an oath of loyalty to the federal government or what? Be expelled through Union lines, away from their homes, into Confederate lines. A dramatic measure in the summer of 1862. He issued an order that required southern civilians to repair the damage done by Confederate raiders on Union facilities, railroads. And not only that, the southern civilians who were impressed to repair that damage were required to pay for whatever food the federal government supplied them in the course of doing their work. All of this was a dramatic change in policy. And it hinted at a harder war that was to come. It hinted, it foreshadowed, the move not toward total war, that was a ways down the road yet, but certainly a war that was waged not just against southern armies, but against the South itself. For that policy to advance in Virginia, John Pope had to win a victory. Now, Lincoln had one other hope associated with Pope's arrival in Virginia. He, of course, was largely supportive of this changing war effort, whereas many conservatives in America at the time, conservative Democrats at the time, were very much concerned. Now, who were the leading voices for a more conservative approach to war in Virginia in 1862? The most famous of them all? George Brinton McClellan, in command in the Army of the Potomac. And so, by bringing Pope to Virginia, win victories, change the nature of war, and supersede, save Lincoln from the need to relieve a very popular commander. So Pope's job, too, was to win victories so that by acclamation he could and would supersede the very popular George Brinton McClellan in command of the nation's largest army. A man who was avowedly opposed and publicly opposed to this emerging new type of war. So when you walk the fields at Manassas this weekend, you are indeed tracking individual events on the battlefield. You're talking about men who are seeking to control pieces of ground that have great relevance to the security and success of their army in the field. And the success or not of that army had huge implications, not just militarily, but socially and politically. There are a few battles in the Eastern Theater that can be so closely tied to questions of policy in Washington. And of course, I presume you all know the outcome of the story. It's no surprise that Pope lost. And by losing, he not only failed in the one charge that he had from Lincoln, which was to win victories, he failed in the second, because this concept of a changing war was not viable unless it was accompanied by victory. And he failed in the third, because by losing at Second Manassas, he left Lincoln no choice but to slide McClellan, the intellectual enemy of the administration, back into command. And put upon him, Lincoln, the unpleasant task of what? On November 10th, 1862. He had to relieve George Brinton McClellan. Waited till the elections were over, of course, to do it. But it was a significant setback for Lincoln. So I would offer to you, that, and you'll get the battle narration for sure, and we can talk about any part of the battle you want, that this is a battle from the Union perspective that has tremendous implications for the Union war effort. But more than that, tells us so much about why battles in general matter. beyond the simple understanding of the human experience on the battlefield, which is important and is certainly a part of the American fabric. But I would suggest to you it's simply not enough when you walk these places. So I would throw that out in mind, out for you to consider as you go along around the field. Now, we can talk about anything you want. I don't know if I just provoked anybody with anything that I just said. I have a list of 10 questions here, but I would be more than happy to answer or accept some of your challenges or assertions. Yes?
Yeah, the penetration of Thoroughfare Gap by Jackson and then Longstreet. Do you have some insight as to how these guys did that? The whole Yankee army in the vicinity and not getting
Well, of course, Thoroughfare Gap, as most of you know, maybe not all of you, is the place where Route 66 today runs through the Bull Run Mountains. It is a flat gap. In fact, most people drive through there. You know, you see Chapman's Mill on the right-hand side as you're going west, and Broad Run running through there on Route 55 and the interstate. But most people don't even know you're going through a mountain. Well, it's not really a mountain. It's a hill pass, but we call it a mountain hereabouts. But it was the easiest way to get across the Bull Run Mountains, and thus the obvious route. Route 55 was the major northwest-southwest route, parallel the Manassas Gap Railroad in 1862. As to Jackson, when he arrived there on the afternoon or on the morning of August 26, 1862, this part of his wide flanking march around the Union Army, as the two armies kind of eyed each other down on the Rappahannock River, after several days of stalemate, after several days of an outstanding performance by John Pope, by the way, Lee, of course, discovered that this was a possibility. And then what did he do? He turned to the man within his command who was best suited to do something like that. It wasn't James Longstreet. Longstreet was not that sort of guy. And I would suggest to you, and again, I would say to you that Second Manassas is the greatest of all case studies of the Army in Northern Virginia. If you want to know how the Army in Northern Virginia was intended to work at its highest level, Second Manassas is the only place where the four great characters of the Army, Lee, Jackson, Longstreet, and Stuart, were all doing what they did best in the same place at the same time. Now, one of Lee's gifts as a commander was, at least as far as Longstreet and Jackson were concerned, recognizing the abilities and strengths of each, and not asking one to do what the other was best suited to do. Now, Jackson's success in this war was generally not a function of great battlefield genius. It was a function of his ability to maneuver in the larger realm, the theater. The Valley Campaign is a perfect example. But his performance on battlefields, including Second Manassas, was pitted by episodes of mediocrity. Bonner Farm was no sterling performance by Jackson, certainly. The afternoon of August 30th is one of the gaping question marks in Jackson's tactical record. But mind you, too, that Jackson's only experience, excuse me, Lee's only experience with Jackson, with him under direct command, was where? During the 7 days, where Jackson had his most difficult days. But Lee certainly understood the genius of the Valley Campaign, and so he turned to Jackson to create opportunity out of nothing. And that's what Jackson did. He was, as I often said, like a point guard on a basketball team. Whereas Longstreet was more reactive, not nearly as aggressive, except when the time called for it, and we'll talk about that later. So Lee turns to Jackson, takes 24,000 men on this wide flanking march up to what is today Marshall in the Plains, through Thoroughfare Gap into Bristoe Station, and eventually to Manassas Junction. Breaks the Union supply line there, doing exactly what Lee hoped, forcing Pope to either make a decision, come across the river and fight Longstreet there, never entered Pope's mind, or to turn and, as he put it, bag Jackson. Those were Pope's words. But when Jackson went through on the 26th, there was nobody there. There might have been a handful of pickets there, but nobody there of any, no force at all in the neighborhood to stop him. Now, when Longstreet came, different circumstance altogether. And here you get into John Pope as a leader. Pope had several habits that played directly into Lee's strengths. One of which was to, first off, he always, Pope did, assume that the enemy would do what he hoped he would do. And secondly, during this campaign at least, Pope repeatedly did exactly what Lee wanted him to do. Now, you know, you can't really give Lee credit for that, but the whole question of imagination, these guys had to be incredibly gifted conceptual thinkers to take the tiny bits of information that they had about troops appearing here and troops appearing there and fill in the blanks and draw in their own mind's eye a mental picture of what was going on. And some of these men had that ability. Lee clearly did. Some of them did not. John Pope clearly did not have that ability to kind of see the big picture. And so once Pope turned after Jackson on the 26th into the 27th, he focused on nothing else. And of course, therein lies Lee's greatest opportunity in this battle, and that is the use of Longstreet's wing of the army, which he uses tremendously well. Now, Longstreet follows by a day and a half, gets to the Gap in the afternoon. There are no Yankees in the Gap. Sends troops through Thoroughfare Gap to this side of the Gap and finds Yankees coming from the other direction. One of the great misconceptions about Thoroughfare Gap is that the Union Army ever held it. They did not. The Confederates, by the time the Yankees arrived, were already through. And the battle was by the Yankees trying to eject the Confederates from Thoroughfare Gap. Now, the fact that there was only a division of Union troops there is reflective of the fact that Pope was so focused on Jackson that he didn't have the conceptual ability to understand that he could do more than one thing at a time. And so, I've got to get over the beeping first. We're taping this, and there's a timing button, and I got to stop when it beeps. So, but Pope simply did not have the imagination to do two things at once. He could have easily blocked the gaps in the mountains, but he was so intent on chasing Jackson, he did not. And so, by the time the battle erupted there in the afternoon, it was exactly opposite of what most people presume. And that is the Yankees holding the Gap and the Confederates fighting their way through. Simply not true. It was just the opposite. And another important fact is the fighting at Thoroughfare Gap delayed James Longstreet beyond his intended timetable not a single second. Lee arrived there in the afternoon about 3 o'clock and immediately ordered Longstreet into bivouac. Going through the Gap, rejoining Jackson in the morning was sufficient enough for Lee. So, in that sense, the fight at Thoroughfare Gap represents only a lost opportunity for the Union and not a significant threat to Lee or Jackson or Longstreet's plans. Yes?
I'd like to thank you for the book. It really motivated the Kettle Run sign and also the Battle of the Bull Run Bridge sign.
Which, by the way, the whole thing at Kettle Run is much bigger than people realize. Very significant.
It leads to my question. For 6 days, the fighting starting at the Kettle Run of the bridge and ending at the Battle of Ox Hill, levels and casualties, I think Gettysburg is the only other battle that would have come about the casualties in that 6 day period. I wonder why they broke it off to a 3 day, even not even including August 27th, which I believe set the table for the eventual battle.
Right. Well, I think you see, I mean, battles that are controlled by subordinate commanders are almost always accorded a secondary significance. And of course, the fight at Kettle Run, which reflected the clash between the Confederates at Manassas Junction and Bristoe Station, confronting Pope as he turned east away from the river. That was Pope's vanguard and a very severe battle, over several hundred casualties on the Union side alone at Kettle Run, and one a battle I would suggest that probably even in my book I did not give enough credence to. It occurs to me on reflection that it needed a little bit more attention than that. Certainly a significant affair. But I think the answer to your question is, on all Civil War battlefields, kind of sub-events that are commanded by subordinate commanders generally don't get the kind of attention. So you see Kettle Run almost completely forgotten. You see Taylor's disaster at Manassas Junction almost entirely overlooked. And, of course, the battlefield, except that right at the bridge where the golf course is completely gone today. You see none of those getting very much play. Bonner Farm you do, because Jackson's there, and of course the Iron Brigade's there, and any place the Iron Brigade goes is...
that's where they cut their teeth.
Right. And Chantilly, Jackson's there again. And of course you have two Union generals killed there, which elevates that. With all apologies to Ed Wenzel, whom I love dearly, but in my view, the inescapable conclusion about Chantilly is that it didn't matter. The decisions that would bring the campaign to a conclusion had already been made by the time that battle began. So it was a bloody exclamation point, but one without real impact on the flow of the campaign itself. I know in Ed's efforts to preserve Chantilly, which are, if there's anything heroic associated with battlefield preservation in our lifetime, it's Ed Wenzel's efforts to preserve Chantilly.
My point out, though, on Chantilly, it's the kind of thing of, because of the way it had turned out, it gets forgotten, except for the people who really are interested in it.
Right.
Had it gone the other way, had Lee successfully cut off Pope's army for the defense of Washington, the last turning maneuver.
Right.
Everything from the peninsula on up has been turning maneuvers. The very things that we always hear about Rommel coming to Nehemiah to study.
Right.
Because that way, when the tank warfare came to fruition.
Right.
He's studying that new modern mobile army.
Right.
It was just the bridge too far. It was the last attempt to try and get Pope's army. Had it gone the other way, that might have been the pivotal battle of the war, given the political aspects.
Sure.
Right? 1862, Lee now stands unopposed with Burnside down at a quiet church, McClellan coming up from the peninsula, and nothing between him and the northern cities.
Right.
And the political aspect, not the force of the army, and of course with all of the Union there with their resources, but it would be the political aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe
mm-hmm.
we made a mistake. Let mm-hmm. them go.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Right. Yes.
This is a basic question, but why was there a second Manassas?
Well, very good question, because there didn't need to be. For the Union to achieve its end, which was the security of Washington and eventually the recombination of the Army of the Potomac coming from the peninsula with Pope's Army of Virginia operating in northern Virginia, Pope did not need to fight a battle to accomplish that. At any point during this event, he could have, in accordance with orders, fallen back across Bull Run, through Centerville, back into the Washington defenses, and achieved the purpose, what the main military purpose of his campaign. Now, that said, as we just discussed, there was much more going on here than military judgments. And so he chose to fight a battle. And he never explains really why. It's easy to imagine that he saw an opportunity to defeat Jackson and Lee. I mean, what Union general wouldn't aspire to do that? He saw an opportunity by doing so to supersede McClellan and accomplish the administration's goal of rendering McClellan irrelevant in the Eastern Theater any longer. Now, that's from the Union perspective. It was a battle that didn't need to be fought. And Pope's decision to fight it, and it was his decision to fight it, is the single most obviously important decision of the campaign, and probably the worst decision of the campaign. From the Confederate perspective, I was going into this, when I started working on this, You know, I kind of had this perception of Lee as the ever-aggressive, determined, you know, we're going to beat him no matter what. But that clearly emerged not to be the case with Lee at 2nd Manassas. He was looking for an opportunity to win a battle of decisive scale, perhaps a battle of annihilation. But if that opportunity to fight that sort of battle, to win that sort of victory on that scale did not come to him, he was prepared to let Pope go. Clearly he was prepared to let Pope go. On August 30th, the great decisive day of the battle, when Longstreet, of course, wins it in the afternoon, the Confederate plan is to let the battle go by, let the day go by without initiating battle. And then that night, to mount what would eventually become the March to Chantilly, up Gum Springs Road, down Route 50, and that collision. And that would have rendered Chantilly a much bigger deal than it was. But Lee was ready to let Pope go. But Pope initiated battle. And when he initiated battle and was defeated at the Deep Cut, during the attacks at the Deep Cut, both Lee and Longstreet, who were not together at the moment, interpreted the situation in exactly the same way. And agreed, from a distance, that now was the time, you know, to snap those jaws shut with the Union Army inside. And let me just conclude this with a comment about Longstreet. Longstreet, here was the opportunity, not created by him, but delivered to him. And here is Longstreet, the man of great delay at Gettysburg, and I say that with, you know, kind of a little bit of a sarcastic tone. You know, the habitual slowness at the Wilderness, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And yet he launches an attack on the afternoon of August 30th that is more than twice the size of Pickett's charge, has half again as much ground to cover, much more difficult ground to cover, and he does it not with the 6 hours of preparation that he exercised and had before Pickett's charge, but with about 20 minutes preparation. The attack by Longstreet on the afternoon of August 30th, 1862, is one of the remarkable events in the history of the Army in Northern Virginia. And I would just, by way of comparison, point out to you that Longstreet, in 3 hours, lost more men than Jackson had in 3 days. So intense was the fighting on Longstreet's front, on the south end of the field, New York Avenue, Chin Ridge, and Henry Hill, at the conclusion of the battle. But very good question. Very good question. Yes?
Could you talk a little bit about the Pope and Porter controversy?
Okay. Of course, this again is a function of this tremendous stress within the Union war effort over what this war should be about. Fitzjohn Porter was one of the more dashing generals in the Army of the Potomac. He was George Brent McClellan's right-hand man, if you will. His favorite friend in the Army, his favorite corps commander in the Army. And the single most important articulator, that's not a very good word, but communicator of the Army's perspective, the conservative patriots' view of war, which was a perfectly legitimate view that the war effort should be limited, that the war aims should not include transformation of anybody's society at all. It should simply be an effort to revert back to that surgical, military-oriented effort to restore the Union with as little pain and suffering on the part of the Southern people as possible. Now, how did Porter play this role? Well, he largely did it by virtue of a relationship that he had with a man named Manton Marble, who was the editor of a newspaper, a Democratic newspaper, called the New York World. And if you go through the New York World in the summer of 1862, you will see all sorts of editorials written by Marble that are the perfect encapsulation of the conservative patriots' view of war. And if you go through Fitzjohn Porter's papers at the Library of Congress, you will find letters written by him to Manton Marble that clearly are the underpinnings for the arguments that Marble makes in the newspaper. Tremendously influential voice and a very powerful figure in the Army. Now, Porter is a smart man, not a particularly energetic officer. You know, he's more reactive. He's somewhat effective in the field, very charismatic, but very political, not with a big P, but with a little P, and very determined. McClellan, Porter mistrusted Pope profoundly, and of course, the mistrust was reciprocated. You know, when Pope issues his orders, you know, live off the land, oaths of allegiance, all that sort of stuff, what does McClellan do? He issues a set of orders that says we will conduct this war, our army will conduct this war based on the highest Christian principles. We will not interfere with slavery. So you have actually a public debate going on. And Porter engenders or at least develops an enmity for Pope that was deep-rooted. In fact, 3 weeks before the battle, Porter writes to one of his friends about Pope, saying the general has written himself to be what we all have known, an ass. And if the policy that he practices is fulfilled, you may look for disaster. 3 weeks. That's early August, 1862. August 22nd, Fitzjohn Porter, that man, comes under John Pope's command. So this man who had predicted with some glee Pope's demise now has as his job to prevent it from happening. And of course, his attitudes were well known. And so you can imagine, and you can certainly excuse Pope for having a little bit of suspicion of what was going on with Fitzjohn Porter. And then as the campaign progresses, he writes a note, several notes to Ambrose Burnside, his friend, McClellan's friend, about Pope, predicting his failure. August 27th, he writes one. He writes famously that we should leave Pope to get out of his own scrape. And so what all that does is it creates an atmosphere in which everything that Fitzjohn Porter is going to be interpreted through a lens. Is what Fitzjohn Porter is doing an attempt to fulfill his prophecy that Pope will fail? Is he contributing to Pope's failure? And so when, on August 29th, there's confusion, we'll say charitably, about what Porter's orders are, it was very easy for John Pope to build a case that suggested that Porter was acting in a perfidious way in order to ensure that Pope was not successful in the field. And so, Fitzjohn Porter was brought up on charges. He was court-martialed for disobeying orders. Orders, in fact, that he never received in time to execute. But the important thing here isn't Porter was caught in a game that was far bigger than him. And his trial is a reflection of this larger struggle between these conservative patriots fighting tenaciously to affect the nature of war, the Union war aims, and the administration fighting tenaciously to expand those war aims. And so Abraham Lincoln, and I would suggest to you that maybe of all the things that we talk about, this is the single most important outcome, the most enduring impact of the Second Manassas Campaign to the history of this nation. Because the Second Manassas Campaign embodies McClellan talking about taking his army to Washington to have, as he says, a conversation with the people in power there. And there are all sorts of whispers like this that fundamentally question the authority of the civilian over the military in this nation. And so Lincoln ultimately ends that question. He ends the debate, the army's debate over war aims. How? By removing the debaters. And the most powerful message sent during that process of removing the debaters was the court-martial of Fitzjohn Porter. This is what will happen to you if you engage in discussions that military men have no right to engage in publicly. That even if there is question about your guilt, you're going to end up hung. Of course, not literally. He was never hung. But he was cashiered and dismissed from the army for that. And I would suggest to you that his dismissal, along with the relief of McClellan in November, along with the relief of William B. Franklin later, and a dozen other men, William Thomas Harbaugh Brooks, all sorts of men, represents ultimately the triumph of the civil over the military in this country. Never again, never again, except with MacArthur, do you hear military, but never again do you hear armies. And that's the distinction between MacArthur and McClellan. Never again do you hear armies rumbling about marching on Washington in this nation. And it was all, the Porter case was an integral part of that process. He brought it, in many respects, on himself. He absolutely was not guilty of what he was accused of, but it was way bigger than his guilt or innocence. Yes?
Yeah, I haven't finished your book yet, but...
Well, my wife hasn't gotten past page 12 yet, so don't worry about it.
Sounds like fun. Why swing east towards Ox Hill? Why not head for the forts at Leesburg and whatever, going up north to establish a position?
Well, I think it gets back to Lee seeking... None of the movements that he undertook, from Jackson's flank march to the movement to Ox Hill, entailed an unalterable commitment to the offensive, to a battle. What he was doing was looking for an opportunity that if he could get between the Union Army and Washington, and there was a favorable opportunity for a decisive, destructive battle, not just a battle, but a decisive, destructive one, he would take it. But he was very careful to leave his options open. Jackson's flank of march, it's risky, but boy, when you look closely at the arrangements that they had made, the risk suddenly doesn't seem so great.
How about after the second Manassas battle, why go to Germantown?
Because he was looking for that opportunity. He hoped another movement might create the type of opportunity that he had had on August 30th. And hadn't succeeded. Now, here's another question that I throw out to you and just postulate. The Union Army that marched back into Washington on September 2nd and 3rd was probably the most demoralized, not frightened, not panicked like 1st Manassas, but purely demoralized army that the... I'll stop now. 3 seconds. Tell me when. To march under the American flag during the Civil War. I say that, not sure I believe it entirely, but they're probably up there. I would ask you, what was the one thing that could happen at that moment in time that might rejuvenate that army?
Bring back McClellan.
Well, bring back McClellan, but even that, I would suggest, but to rejuvenate it, to put it in fighting condition within a matter of 3 days, one thing. And that is the Confederates crossing the Potomac.
Yep.
Robert E. Lee did the one thing that was most likely to rejuvenate the determination, if not the spirits, of the Union Army then in Washington. Not to suggest that it was a bad decision, but to suggest that it is an unintended consequence that historians have completely overlooked. And so what would have happened had he not gone into Maryland? It's an interesting... Would Lincoln have had time to reconsider putting McClellan back in command? The northern newspapers spent 2, 3, 4 weeks dwelling on the disaster at Second Manassas rather than 2 days? Because Lee's in Maryland now. So lots of interesting questions. Yes, sir.
Yeah, in landscape terms, Brad Stevens here goes into the options Lee had after Chantilly and the conclusion of the Second Manassas as to where he should go, whether he should go back south into the Shenandoah, and Lee chose Antietam. Do you think that was his best choice? It was up to you. Can you see, would you have handled the Antietam Maryland campaign different from what Lee did?
No one's ever asked me that before. I personally don't think, you know, Lee was in a game now that, and he understood this, every decision he made was shaped by Union politics. From the time he took command to Appomattox, he knew that the biggest impact that he was going to have was not against Union armies. He defeated them easily enough. The biggest impact he needed to have, the one that would threaten the Union war effort, was the solidarity of the Union body politic in the North. And, of course, he went into Maryland with the hope of staying there long enough to kind of be this gnawing cancer that would affect the fall elections. It's hard to imagine that any Union army in any condition would have allowed him to stay there for long. I don't know. I mean, I'm not very good at what ifs. I will say that it's interesting to consider the possibilities if he had just let it fester. In two ways. Number one, the effect on the Union war effort. And number two, on his ability to kind of rejuvenate his own army. I think his biggest mistake of the campaign as it extended into Maryland was simply asking too much of his army. And he found in the end that they were unable to fulfill his hopes on Antietam Creek.
Well, some didn't buy into crossing.
Well, some did not. Yes.
Okay. You mentioned the policy aims of the Union. Can you mention the policy aims of the Confederacy vis-a-vis the military?
Sure. Robert E. Lee, in many ways, had a much easier job than did Union commanders. Number one, he didn't have a committee on the conduct of the war looking over his shoulders. Number two, he was much better at getting along with his boss than McClellan was. He was assiduous about making sure that Davis was informed, satisfied with the information that he had, and so had much greater freedom. That said, not having to view his army as a part of the political spectrum in Washington, which every Union army commander had to, Lee was able to focus instead on the impact that his army could have on Union politics, rather than worrying about his own his own national politics on his own level. And again, there's a great quote in which Lee writes. He says, "We should stop at nothing to cause disaffection, dissatisfaction in the northern populace, and to bring upon them some of the uncertainties that have afflicted us as this war goes on." And I would argue that everything that he did in command of the army had a military objective, yes, but dominantly a political objective. And, you know, by 1864, that is why the Army of Northern Virginia was virtually the only realistic hope that the Confederacy had. That is why Lee was elevated to such a lofty place in Southern culture before the end of the war, because he was the only one who could affect the one thing that might bring a happy outcome to the war after 1862. And that was, of course, a Northern populace that abandoned the war effort and sought peace. And so I would suggest that he was far less busy dealing with his own internal politics than he was thinking about Union politics, which points out a very important characteristic of Lee, and that is that he spent very little time worrying about what the other guy was going to do to him, and spending all of his energy thinking about what he was going to do to the other guy. And in that sense, McClellan was just the opposite, the perfect fit, because what did McClellan do? He spent all his time worrying about what the other guy was going to do to him. And so, in that sense, when Lee said later that McClellan was my most difficult opponent, it was probably because McClellan was so programmed to think kind of defensively rather than offensively that he was perhaps more effective in that realm than many of Lee's other opponents in the Union armies in the East. Yes, sir?
From a policy standpoint, should Lee have paid some attention to what was going on west of the Allegheny Mountains?
Well, number one, it wasn't his job. Right, it wasn't his job. He was.
No, but I mean, he confined his job. He didn't really give it. Did he give a perspective as to what went on later on?
Right.
Instead of sending the Corps to try to break through to Vicksburg, he's
right.
Going back into Pennsylvania. I mean, it didn't seem to be. He seemed to confine himself to a policy that was restricted to defending Virginia.
You're right. You're right. And I think, again, that's a function of the fact that he understood that when people wanted to know how the war was going, they didn't look to Tennessee or Mississippi. They looked to Virginia. That was the great barometer. And he knew that his failure in Virginia would have tripled the implications of Braxton Bragg's failures in Tennessee. And so there's no question as the war went on that he was forced to think more broadly and was asked to think more broadly and did think more broadly, although never as broadly, for example, as, say, McClellan did, who was a broad thinker and a strategic thinker. But that's always been one of the criticisms of Lee. Yes?
Yeah. You talk a lot about Lee and the decision. What about Davis and his role and how that came about, how they worked together on that?
Well, I think that it's very clear that Davis had great faith in Lee. There was no impulse in Davis to ride to Manassas, second Manassas, as he had at first Manassas. I think Davis respected Lee and Lee's ability, gave him room to, you know, he did not put the kind of strictures on Lee that, for example, Lincoln did in the spring and summer of 1862 with McDowell and the McClellan situation and withholding all those troops to defend Washington. He allowed Lee to make those military judgments largely, and Lee did. Lee repaid him with not always honest respect and consultation. I write about in the book, August 21st, the day that Lee, who has thus far, to this point in the campaign, down at Remington, maintained some connection with Richmond. But on August 21st, he decides he can't. That for him to be successful in moving against Pope, he needs to move upriver and ultimately break that connection with Richmond. He makes that decision in the morning, issues the orders in the morning, and then in the afternoon writes Davis a letter saying, well, tell me what you think about this. It was a done deal already, but it's indicative of Lee's efforts to engage Davis in an appropriate way, knowing what Davis's response would be. So they had a very different relationship than the Union commanders had with their high command.
Was the Southern foreign diplomacy involved in this decision?
To go into Maryland?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, just as the Emancipation Proclamation was seen by many as a means to forestall European intervention, a victory on northern soil was seen by many, including Lee, as a means to hasten foreign intervention. And, of course, in 1862, foreign intervention was one of the major short-term objectives of the Confederacy. Yes?
What do you characterize the relationship between Jackson, Lee, and Longstreet? In the sense of how they saw each other, and maybe how they saw the, you know, called pecking order, the importance of each other.
Well, I think that the only one that really mattered on that was Lee's relationship with them. Jackson and Longstreet, there's no evidence that they had any kind of nobody had a warm personal relationship with Jackson. Gary Gallagher's point out, and rightly so. I mean, who did Lee choose to travel with? Longstreet. And given Jackson's demeanor and his style, you know, it's not surprising. It's interesting, for example, at Second Manassas, and again, I think all of them were flexible enough and realistic enough to understand that they needed to yield to the person who knew the most at the moment. They trusted each other's judgment. Longstreet's line at Second Manassas was not selected by Longstreet. Wasn't selected by Lee. It was selected by Jackson. And it was selected by Jackson to remedy the weaknesses of his own line, largely, which was a complete absence of artillery, usable artillery along Jackson's line. And so he continued his line southward, filling the gap, of course, with ultimately about two battalions of artillery in there. But that was Jackson's determination to extend that line to the south. And there's no record that Lee disputed it. It was a decision that Pope never anticipated. He knew that Longstreet was coming on the field, but he assumed that Longstreet was going to go directly to Jackson's support. And so the miracle of Second Manassas is you have, you know, Jackson here, Longstreet here, John Pope right there, 2 miles away, 30,000 men within 2 miles 30,000 of Longstreet's men within 2 miles of Pope's headquarters for 30 hours, and Pope doesn't know that they're there. Despite having been told several times that they were there. And, of course, you know, it is easy to laugh at that, but, I mean, the cognitive process that you have to use to get yourself to that point of denial is a very interesting one. And it's rooted not just in Pope's own kind of mental inabilities, which, by the way, as near as I can tell, were largely confined to this 10-day period. The rest of his career, he was pretty good. But also is affected by this tension between the Army of the Potomac and the Army of Virginia. Perfect example of that comes about 2 o'clock on the afternoon of August 30th. John Reynolds, who's in command of the Division of Pennsylvania Reserves, is in position in front of Longstreet on the south side of the Warrenton Turnpike, Route 29. And he goes out there and he sees the Confederates, and he gets on his horse under fire and rides back to Pope's headquarters. His horse is foaming. He jumps down in front of Pope, goes up to Pope, and says, "General, the enemy is turning your left." And Pope says, "I guess not." And then he does something very interesting. Reynolds, of course, was a mainstay of the Army of the Potomac in Porter's Corps. In the Army of the Potomac for much of the time. And Pope summons the only man that he personally had appointed to command in this army, a man named John Buford, cavalry commander, and he says to Buford, "You go out and see if the enemy is turning our left." And so Buford rides off, and of course, by the time word comes back, the enemy had turned their left. So it's a very interesting process that goes on. There's other moments of denial. I mean, you know, there's always a tendency for all of us to hope or wish things are as we wish them to be. And Pope was certainly guilty of that. Lee, if you look at his record of kind of perception and decision making, rarely, if ever, fell into that trap. Yes?
Was Franklin and Sumner in Washington, of course, after the Taylor disaster at the bridge, word gets back, and they're held back by McClellan. Did Lincoln, were they the only divisions left in Washington to defend Washington? And if they were sent out, of course, they could have turned the tide of battle.
Right.
What's your opinion on that?
Well, these were the two major elements of the Army of the Potomac that had not yet joined Pope's army. Of course, two corps had under Heintzelman and Porter. Franklin and Sumner had not yet. They arrived in Alexandria and on August 26th and August 27th. And the first thing that happened was that Henry Halleck, in response to a message from Herman Haupt that the Confederates had gotten into the stores at Manassas Junction somehow, Halleck ordered McClellan to send a brigade out to see what was going on. McClellan protested. He did not want to send a brigade out into, you know, middle of nowhere, not knowing what they were going to run into, but did. Ultimately, was ordered to do so. They went out on the trains, got off just short of Bull Run Bridge at Union Mills, which is still there, crossed the bridge, move into Manassas Junction, and of course, are just engulfed by Jackson's men. A disaster, 250 casualties, most of them captured. Their general is mortally wounded there. All sorts of bad things happen. The fulfillment of McClellan's prediction and fears if he sends troops forward without knowing what's going on. And thus, the justification, and probably not unreasonably so, the justification for Franklin and Sumner not coming forward. After that. Now, I point out the other thing, and this gets back to one of your questions over here. Why was the battle fought in the first place? To achieve the military ends of the campaign, it was fully within Pope's power to join those armies himself. He was absolutely capable of doing that, and in fact had the freedom from Halleck to do so. In fact, not only the freedom, Halleck had suggested it at least twice, that he just fall back into the defenses and let the two armies join. But Pope was unwilling to do that. There are a few forgotten events of the campaign that have bigger implications than that little disaster at Bull Run Bridge on August 27th, 1862. And you've done some markers out there, right? Good job. Yes?
John, can you talk a minute about the role of the Union Cavalry during the Second Manassas Campaign? You hear about the Southern Cavalry and Stuart's revenge for his hat and then
right.
the movement into Manassas Junction, but Union Cavalry is invisible.
Right. Well, the Union Cavalry, in many respects, makes an important step forward in the Second Manassas Campaign. Before this point, they are employed in generally smaller units, smaller brigade-sized units, or individual regiments. McClellan uses his cavalry during the Peninsula Campaign, much as McDowell had used it during First Manassas. One of Pope's contributions was to go to a larger unit of organization, a brigade level. And as the war progresses, you see the cavalry organization becoming larger and larger and more independent. So that's a step forward. He's got three brigades of cavalry under his command. They're not operating together, but at least they're operating in brigade-sized units. But the problem is that Pope became so focused on getting Jackson, on doing what needed to be done, that one of the things that broke down was all of his logistical and staff work. Many men who fought at Second Manassas hadn't been fed for 2 to 3 days. The cavalry, which requires much higher maintenance than foot soldiers, many of the horses were almost broken down by the time the battle occurred. And so as the campaign progresses, the efficiency and usefulness of the Union cavalry diminishes. Then you have the clash of cavalry on the afternoon of August 30th, which actually is a little bit of a milestone in the Union Army because it demonstrates that, you know, in a kind of a stand-up fight, the Union cavalry can function. They were not victorious, but they were determined, and they did surprise the Confederates by their tenacity. So all in all, I think you have to judge that in the realm of cavalry, Pope made two significant contributions. One, the organizational structure. And two, the appointment of John Buford to command. It was a small step forward for sure. Yes?
Just, you alluded to something that was kind of interesting I hadn't really thought a lot about. The intangible of the crossing into Maryland as a rallying cry to the Union now to defend their state.
Right.
Because remember, we thought in terms of I'm a Pennsylvanian,
right.
I'm a Virginian, not an American, so to speak,
right.
defending my homeland.
Right.
And something I hadn't really thought about that was interesting. But Joe Harsh goes to, I mean, his ideas about Lee going out there is more of what we call the tangibles. Harvest was coming in Virginia.
Right.
We need to get that pressure out of there and let that happen. This is the breadbasket. I think Harsh gives a lot of great statistical data
right.
that the South's resources were really at its borders.
Right.
Virginia, Tennessee were the key states. To push that away was to allow that breathing room there,
right.
and perhaps to go to fresh fields themselves.
Right.
Granted, there might be some negative repercussions there. That's why Lee was always very careful to be the gentleman soldier that just fights the army and doesn't wage war against the civilian populace.
Mm-hmm.
And he never deviated from that, no matter
mm-hmm.
how bad things got later
mm-hmm.
on. Any thoughts about that? I mean, the idea, you just hear the negative.
But
it was a new thought.
No question. Joe Harsh did excellent work in this realm. He improved, I think, significantly the thought that I put into it, and I would accept him in a heartbeat over me on that account. So,
Stonewall decided to come out of hiding and take go to battle on Plummer's Corner
on August 28th.
Yeah, the things I heard is all the way from just tactical or target of opportunity all the way to strategic.
Okay. Good question. The question is, why did Jackson decide to kind of come out of hiding to initiate battle at Bronner's Farm? Well, several things had come together. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, one of the things that is largely misunderstood about Second Manassas is that Lee and Jackson were in fairly regular communication when they were separated by all those miles. That afternoon, Jackson had sent a note to Lee informing him that he had taken this position north of the Warrenton Turnpike and could either go to Aldi if Lee wanted to meet up at Aldi. He could retreat if he had to, or he could stay and initiate battle if Longstreet and Lee were ready to come through the mountains. About 5 o'clock that afternoon, Jackson received a return message from Lee saying, "We are here," that is at Thoroughfare Gap, "and we will be through in the morning." And so at that point, Jackson, all the pieces had come together. And he was willing to engage Pope in battle under really three conditions.
May I have your attention, please? The library will close at 9 o'clock. If you need to apply for a library card, please go to the checkout desk at this time. Thank you.
Any of you need library cards? But he really needed three things. One, the surety that Lee and Longstreet would be coming through the next morning. Secondly, he needed to find Pope rather than have Pope find him. And thirdly, he needed a way out if things went badly. And that position around the Bronner Farm offered him all of those things. And so when Rufus King's division meandered by late that afternoon, Jackson was, I won't say he was not hesitant about initiating battle, but he was willing to. Moreover, he did it with two things in mind. One was to destroy King's division, which he failed to do. But secondly, he was sending a message to John Pope. Here I am, come and get me. And it is the most spectacular example in the campaign where Pope wrongly did exactly what Lee and Jackson wanted him to do, because he did. Yes?
Often overlooked future corps commander, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dick Buell, did he play any role? Was he there?
Well, he was the major antagonist at the Battle of Kettle Run on August 27th. He actually did tremendous service in defending the rear of Jackson's column or force as it was at Manassas Junction. He was on the field at the battle, at the opening engagement at Bronner Farm, which is not really the Battle of Bronner Farm. It's just the first day of Second Manassas, and was seriously grievously wounded. It was there that he was wounded in the leg. He was the division commander under Jackson. The division commanders under Jackson at Bronner Farm, at least by appearances, did not perform particularly well. Jackson had a terrible time getting greater numbers engaged at the point of contact. And we don't know why, really. We don't know what Jackson's orders were. We don't know who failed, who succeeded. We only know the result. And that is that a half hour into this battle, where Jackson has 24,000 men at hand, Rufus King has 10,000 men, the Yankees have more men at the point of contact than does Jackson. And throughout the entire battle would never be worse than pretty much equal with them at the point of contact. So Bronner Farm represents certainly a tactical failure. I can't say what role Ewell played in that. Certainly some, but it's been obscured and mooted by the fact that he was so seriously wounded.
I was reading Ronald White's book of biography of Lincoln, and he believes that General Pope was rushed by Lincoln to even up the defeat in Richmond.
The question is, was Pope rushed by Lincoln to kind of redeem the defeat in front of Richmond, right?
Yeah.
There's not a lot of evidence to suggest that. Pope's movements early in the campaign are very methodical, keyed toward consolidating his army, getting it together. And then once the campaign begins, in fact, if you read Halleck as a reflection of Lincoln's desires, Halleck was very much willing. His first priority was to see to the reunion of the two armies, and then to fight whatever battle needed to be fought. So I would suggest I've not seen any evidence that Pope was rushed by Lincoln. Certainly in war there's always urgency. But there were no real obstacles to Pope acting in the time frame that he did. It wasn't anything like First Manassas.
But John, when General Pope came east, he was kept in Washington.
Right.
He really never got to know his army. That was one of the real problems, right? How much time did he actually spend in Washington?
He came out into the field. He spent almost 5 weeks in Washington. I forget the date that he came out, but about 5 weeks in Washington, testifying before Congress at one point, and various other things. So, again, another argument in favor of certainly a lack of of intense urgency on that account. Yes, I think we've got about, you tell me when we're...
About 5 more minutes.
What's your favorite spot on the battlefield? Where do you like to go?
That's a good question. I think the most interesting sight on... What was that?
Charlie Brown.
I know what it was, but what was it? To me, the most interesting place got the most satisfaction out of coming to understand was Chinn Ridge, and while I think that that is the part of the battle that probably in the end I understood least. I understand it, but less. I think Scott Patchen, who's not here, I don't think, right? He should be here. Scott's written a wonderful book about Chinn Ridge and that I read years ago, and I'm not sure what its status is today. But that is the scene of the most intense sustained combat. That is the site where the magnitude of Confederate victory, not the fact of Confederate victory, that was already determined, but the magnitude of that victory would be determined on Chinn Ridge. That is the decisive ground at Second Manassas.
That's where the rubber hit the road.
Yeah. Yes?
Regarding Chinn Ridge, do you have any information on Captain Kearns staying on Chinn Ridge?
Well, Mark Kearns' battery was actually not on Chinn Ridge. It was on the hill to the west of Chinn Ridge. Kearns was a captain of a Pennsylvania battery. We haven't talked about Irvin McDowell tonight, who is the great goat of Second Manassas, and I believe rightly so. But McDowell made the single most significant tactical mistake, I think, on any eastern battlefield during the Civil War. In responding to the failure of Porter's attack, he ordered the entire Pennsylvania Reserve Corps and others off of Chinn Ridge to the north side of the turnpike. When Longstreet's men assaulted, the tail end of that column included Mark Kearns' battery. His battery and another Pennsylvania brigade went into position on this knoll, which today is deep, deep in the deepest pine forest you'll ever see, almost impenetrable, but you can get there. And Kearns went into position there, and over the next 30 minutes played out one of the heroic scenes of the entire war. As his batterymen were shot down, Kearns stayed by his guns. As they abandoned the guns, he stayed by his guns until he was the only one working the guns. And as the Confederates approached, they bid upon him to surrender and give up. He continued to work the guns, and as he reached the next guns, the Texans approaching him leveled their guns and shot him down. He was mortally wounded. The Texans rushed into the battery, captured the guns, and several of them approached Kearns. One of them asked, "Why did you do what you did?" And he purportedly said to them, "I promised to die under my guns, save my guns or die under them, and I have kept my promise." And he died. We don't have a picture of Mark Kearns. There are several people who have worked on Kearns over the years, but he's one of the obscure. If that had happened at Gettysburg, you'd have, you know, he'd be up there with Joshua Chamberlain. But because it happened in a pine scrub forest at Manassas, no one's ever heard of it. But a truly remarkable. If you get to the site, I think there's somebody once put out a pile of stones. Have you been back there? Someone's been back there lately. I think there's a little pile of stones that someone guessed that's where they are. It's hard to tell where you are when you're in that forest because it's just so thick. But I've been back up there in a couple times, but I'm not going back up there again. It's ticks. Last question, if there is one. John, you get it.
Preservation, the situation referenced at Walmart on the Wilderness battle.
Right. The question about Walmart at Wilderness. Walmart took out a full-page ad in the Fredericksburg Freelance Star today advocating for a Walmart. I don't think that's going to change any minds, but what it does indicate is Walmart's determination to see this project through to successful completion. There have been times, and we've met with Walmart several times, where I did have questions as to whether they were determined enough to want to do this in the face of opposition. We got that answer today. I don't think there are the votes in Orange County. The only way that the Walmart doesn't happen right now is if Walmart decides it doesn't happen, and the fact that they took out a full-page ad there certainly doesn't suggest they're heading in that direction. So it's not good news. Not good news. Well, thank you very much.